Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of the Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community improvement the norm in this sector rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to welcome Roger Hughes as my guest on Making Change, and I'm especially pleased to do so today of all days, as I'm speaking with Roger on the occasion of his retirement party, following a career in philanthropy that has spanned three decades. As director of the Roy J. Carver Charitable Trust in Iowa, president of the Iowa College Foundation in Des Moines, in development and faculty positions at St. Norbert College, at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, and at Indiana University, and now, after 16 years, as the founding CEO of St. Luke's Health Initiatives, a health conversion foundation in Phoenix, Arizona. It is at St. Luke's Health Initiatives, or SLHI as you'll hear Roger refer to it, that Roger has had the unique opportunity to redefine the role of funders in creating community health and to also redefine community health itself. Roger's leadership has led SLHI to a well-deserved reputation for pushing the boundaries of what is possible when we simply believe that anything is possible. I have been privileged to work with Roger and SLHI on many projects over the years, and their work is consistently an inspiration to my own work. It is therefore a very real pleasure to have Roger Hughes share his observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Roger Hughes with St. Luke's Health Initiatives in Phoenix. Welcome, Roger.
I'm very happy to be here.
It is really pretty wonderful to be able to talk with you on this particular day, which is your segue into retirement from St. Luke's.
You're getting me on an up day. I mean, not only a day of reflection for the past, but also kind of a certain amount of trepidation, but also I think a certain amount of anticipation for my coming rewirement. After having had like over 30 years in the field of philanthropy, running foundations and such, I get to look at a whole new chapter of my life. And, you know, frankly, I'm looking forward to it.
That's
I'm
good.
Especially looking forward to not driving into work every morning.
That alone is a gift.
It is.
That alone is a gift. I'll start out by asking the same question that I start just about all of my interviews with, which is in the decades that you have been doing this work and observing change happening in communities, what do you see happening that leads to change when you're seeing change happen?
There's a lot of things that lead to change, and a lot depends on where you look and what your definition of community is, and also what your definition of significant change is. But the one constant that I always see is that in situations where you see significant social change, whether it's at the movement level or at the neighborhood or community level, you see people who see themselves differently than they did before. And they think differently than they did before. And usually it's because of a very powerful vision or a powerful idea or a powerful goal that kind of brings communities together. But without that, you know, without that internalization and without living and being the change that you want to see in your life, I just don't think you'll see significant social change.
An interesting way of putting it, coming from a funder. Have you always been like this? Has this always been what you've brought to change?
Well, it's the way I've always personally been. Actually, everything I learned about social change, I learned from playing in rock and roll bands during the 60s and 70s. I used to make my living as a professional musician. And everything I learned about working with groups, motivating people, practicing with people, rehearsing with people, entertaining people, and the traits of leadership, and seeing the kinds of changes that you wanted to see at the micro level and transferring them to the macro level. It was making things up, literally, improvisation, that literally informed all the work that I've been doing. I haven't always been in environments where I've been able to practice it. And fortunately, my career here at SLHI, which began in 1995, I've really been blessed with working with a really open and embracing board that is willing to take risks and try new things. And it's been a blessing.
And it's been a blessing for the communities that you're working in. When did you start at St. Luke's?
Well, I started in 1995. And I'll give you an example of what a difference an idea makes.
Mm-hmm.
We started as a traditional grant maker. We put out guidelines and people sent in proposals on a regular basis. And we said yes or no. And then they sent in reports. And then we kind of went on to the next thing. One day, a psychology professor was visiting with me, and he was talking about his research he was doing with older adults. And he was studying the attribute of resilience. And he was looking at two groups of people. One was a group of older adults with arthritis who actually were optimistic, you know, filled with hope and energy. And the other was a group of adults also with the same degree of arthritis who lacked that same set of resiliency and adaptiveness. And what he discovered is that the former group, even though they had a debilitating illness, they focused on what they could do, not what they couldn't do. They focused on their strengths and their assets, whereas the latter group couldn't get beyond focusing on the things they couldn't do. And kind of a light bulb went off in my head, and I said to myself, you know, my wife and I try to raise our children in this asset strength-based mode, and we don't dwell on deficits, and why would I think I could run an organization any differently? And
wow.
I began to talk about that with the board, and I began to talk about that with staff, and everyone became energized by that central idea, and we came up with the idea of health in a new key. Instead of focusing on health as just the absence of some physical or mental disease, we really focused on health as the total integration of mind, body, and spirit in a responsive community.
Wow.
And we made some investments in health, what we call health in a new key communities, and we saw the power of ideas and the investment in human capital to shape people who in turn shape their communities. And it's just a really a powerful thing.
Talk about a change in idea and a change in thinking. It's radical.
Well, it was radical for us,
yeah.
particularly coming from what I would call a traditional grant-making mode. But the other thing that we see, you know, when we look at significant social change is this whole idea of leadership, and particularly collective leadership. If I'm like you, or if you're like me, rather, you've probably been involved in a lot of meetings where you get a bunch of heavy hitters who sit around the table and they talk wise about projects and what they're going to do, and nothing ever really changes.
Right.
But then you go out and start working in communities with everyday people, and you see literally thousands of people that are working with their neighbors, working across and through networks, where leadership is spread out across the network in a collaborative kind of a way rather than in a authoritarian, top-down kind of a fashion. And I think when you see significant social change, you see that kind of collective leadership.
Yeah. Do you have some examples of where you've seen that happening with the projects that you guys are working with?
Sure. I'll give you just two examples. One that shows these principles, and the other which shows the lack of these principles. One example in a community in West Central Phoenix that is predominantly, but not exclusively, Hispanic, and there's a fair number of, at least when this project was going on, a fair number of people who are in the country illegally. They were focused on community change in the area, particularly focused on children and maternal health. And they used the idea of promotores, who are community health workers, trained community health workers, who actually come from the community and don't come from outside. And these promotores go out and call on, in this case, women, young women with their children, and talk to them about health issues. What are some of the issues they have? How do they need help in dealing with them, et cetera, et cetera.
So these are just neighborhood women who happen to be trained. So they're not outsiders, but they're neighborhood women talking to other neighborhood women.
That's right. And in this particular case, when they went out and talked to women about maternal and child health issues, what they found, at least on the first go-around, was that the women weren't particularly concerned about or interested in those issues. What they were more immediately interested in were the large number of stray dogs that were in their neighborhood and that made it unsafe for the children to play outside. And so they helped to organize these women and making an appeal to the city of Phoenix, to deal with the issue of stray dogs. And so they ended up improving the safety of the neighborhood, but more importantly, it began to instill in the women and in that neighborhood a sense of empowerment. We really can come together to deal with a social issue. You know, the other thing that that community had is a strong community center that provided education and recreational and social support activities. And the promotoras began to draw the women into the center, and it built up, you know, it built up not only the bonding social capital, the levels of trust between people that you need to develop change, but it also built up the bridging social capital. So these women met people from other groups, other parts of the community that had different skills and interests than their own, but they were able to come together in this kind of a collective community center and work on issues of common concern. Now, in contrast to that, a community on that, another Health in the New Key community in South Phoenix, which is kind of a combination of African American population, Hispanic population, and white, all low income. There hadn't been much what I would, I mean, certainly everybody was friendly and, you know, got along fine. But there wasn't any history of groups working together. It was a community that was very rich in outside social services being delivered through clinics, through behavioral health agencies, some which were administered by schools and social service agencies. But there was the feeling that if you ask people, you know, what the issues were, well, they would go through everything that they didn't have. They didn't have safe streets. They didn't have, you know, access to health care. They didn't have a grocery store where they could get fresh fruits and vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. So they had not developed that kind of a strength, asset-based approach mindset. And even though they had a number of strong community organizations, they were all pretty much identified with one particular part of the population, like an African-American church, for example. And there hadn't been a lot of cross-pollination between the different groups. And it took that community a much longer time to get off the ground, and it never did achieve the same level of success, at least looking at the number of successful community projects and partnerships and networks that were formed compared with the former group. So those are examples of those mm-hmm. ideas kind of, you know, playing out in various degrees in these smaller neighborhood-based communities.
Roger, what do you see that was present in the West Central Phoenix community that wasn't present in the South Phoenix community?
Well, one of the things, in addition to what I've already mentioned, like collective leadership and the presence mm-hmm. of a powerful idea, another thing was what I would call grassroots community organizing. One of the things the Promotores were very good at was bringing people together and helping to organize people. Probably one of my favorite examples of this phenomenon occurred in 1999 when we made a grant to the Arizona Interfaith Project to hire two community organizers, ostensibly for the purpose of identifying people in low-income communities who would be good candidates to enter entry-level healthcare positions through training at community colleges and like. And so they had formed some partnerships with the community colleges, but they needed to go into the community to actually identify people, work with families, provide them with some help, and begin to advocate for this through their churches and such.
Right.
So we awarded the grant, and then we got a report at the end of the grant period, and the director of the Arizona Interfaith Project invited me down to what he called a community celebration to celebrate their first year of work. And he asked me if I would like to attend, and I said, sure. And I said, where's it going to be? Mm-hmm. And he said, it's going to be at the Phoenix Convention Center. And I said, the Phoenix Convention Center, that doesn't sound like a, you know, just a small, you know, place to celebrate an organizing project. So mm-hmm. I showed up on a Sunday afternoon, and there were over 5,000 people there. And they had bused them in from all over the state, from coalitions
wow.
of, you know, churches and, you know, different faiths. And they had invited not only me, but about 50, 60 other community leaders, politicians,
wow.
business people. And they got us all up on the stage, and they asked us to take the pledge. And of course, you couldn't get up on stage and not take the pledge.
And the pledge
and
was?
And the pledge was for a universal health care, amnesty, minimum wage, social
wow.
justice. I mean, it was, to say it was a progressive agenda is a vast
right.
understatement. And, and of course, you know, I work for a board that is very politically and socially diverse, you know, and I
mm-hmm.
was thinking, well, I wonder what some of my more conservative members will think when they see me up here taking the pledge. But we went on to fund that organization for the following 6 years. And it underscores for me one of the things that you see in these communities is this relentless focus on organizing and advocacy. I think one of the things that foundations and other funders need to pay more attention to is actually connecting people to power. And it's
Ooh.
Not just, you know, oftentimes you can go into communities that are rich in this dense web of social reciprocity, and you have many of them are poor urban communities where you have these dense bonding networks of families and churches. But unless
mm-hmm.
these networks have the bridging and the linking social capital to social and political power, it's hard to see that significant change. It's hard to bring mm-hmm. leverage outside resources and help them come into the community. So a lot of foundations, I think, are uncomfortable funding advocacy and organizing. But to me, when you're talking about creating healthy, vital communities, that's how you get it done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. It's really interesting because there's so many different things that St. Luke's has done over the years, and it's been such a privilege to be close enough to watch you guys. The willingness to provide long-term support, the willingness to step into that place of advocacy and to support it, the willingness to acknowledge that sometimes the change you're expecting to see is not going to be that straight line. I mean, I love the story of going from promotoras talking about healthcare to dealing with the number of stray dogs that are running around, because in terms of creating a vital, healthy place to be, that was what was the mm-hmm. most important. I mean, there seems to be a lot of places that you guys have been willing to step into that many funders may shy away from. And if there's one thing that I've noticed about you guys over the years, there's not a lot you shy away from.
Well, one of the things I take some pride in leaving now after 16 years at SLHI, one of the things that I think we have successfully done is created a culture of change and discovery and learning. And so it's not that we're looking for these opportunities, but they just seem to pop up. And rather than say, well, you know, we'd like to do that, but it doesn't fit within our guidelines, so we're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If it looks like there's an opportunity to leverage assets, create healthier communities, develop learning networks of practice, we're willing to make an investment. And I think that increasingly people come to our organization not so much anymore to get money or a grant, although, you know, certainly that's a factor in many cases, but it's really, you know, mm-hmm. just to talk about ideas, to play the role of convener and facilitator, and to develop these rich networks of practice. And it's out of those that you see the leadership and the human capital develop, you know, that creates social change in specific communities.
I'm looking back at the very, very first thing that you mentioned to me, that change happens when we see ourselves as different because of a new idea, because of something powerful, thinking differently. And you guys really have always walked that talk. It's really interesting to me that you are looking first at convening and facilitating and finding the ways from there that you can leverage your dollars, rather than coming in and saying, we're a funder first, we give the dollars, and then, you know, we'll figure out what collaboration means from there.
Yeah, I think that's right. The thing that sticks in my mind, you know, that I always like to go back to is that we did a report in 2000, I think it was 2004, 2005, called Mind, Mood, and Message. It was a study in the greater Phoenix metro area on the pathways that people use to access behavioral health services and to share, you know, common interests and conditions. And it was both the formal and the informal pathways. And what we found was this is really large, impressive web of interconnected self-help groups and institutions and businesses and churches and even, you know, government agencies and informal circles of family and friends. And the thing that jumped out from that study was that this web of economic and social reciprocity, it wasn't particularly efficient. In fact, there were a lot of redundant organizations, mm-hmm. and if somebody had gone in there and talked, well, you know, there's too many behavioral health agencies, you guys ought to merge,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a favorite topic.
Yes.
But the thing is, it wasn't necessarily efficient, but it was effective.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't stable, it wasn't permanent,
right.
but it was adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't arise as a result of some top-down strategic planning exercise, you know, and a lot of formal project interventions, but it grew organically, you know, from the bottom up,
mm-hmm.
you know, through these networks of social reciprocity. And the thing it underscored for me that it was literally self-organizing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to me, you look at really broad-based social movements. I'm thinking of the civil rights movement, and even to some degree the environmental movement and
mm-hmm.
others. These self-organize in so many different ways, and they're not necessarily permanent. and they're not necessarily efficient, but they're remarkably effective and they're adaptable, mm-hmm. and they change with changing conditions. And to me, when you talk about social change, it's like you're never really like, oh, we're done with that, you know, thank God, you know, we're going to go on to the next thing. You're never done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true with an individual or with an organization. And if you think you've reached the finish line, unfortunately, you're just looking in the rear view mirror.
Wow. Because
that's the only place you see a finishing line. You look ahead and you don't see a line.
There's plenty more to do.
You see wide open. Yeah.
Plenty
you know,
more to
so
do.
So there's just plenty more to do.
Well, one last question that's just so on my mind as you are rewiring, as you say, and getting ready to see what's next. Is there advice that you would give to other funders that are really looking to make significant change in their communities?
Well, number one, I think we really started being more successful than not when we thought less of ourselves as a funder.
Mm-hmm.
And more of ourselves as a, you know, as a community catalyst. So I think it's, again, all how you see your work. One thing that I've certainly learned and that I would say to other philanthropic organizations similar to ours is, number one, take the long-term view. Don't invest in short-term projects and expect that you're going to see significant results. And by long term, I'm not talking 5 years. I mean, it could be 10, even 20 years if you're, particularly if you're working on social change in specific place-based communities, and not everybody is.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is you need to deal with the chronic philanthropical disease, funderitis.
And that is?
Funderitis is a chronic, you know, condition in philanthropy that's brought on by insufficient oxygen of risk and the plaque that builds up in your body from excessive command and control culture. And a lot of foundations, you know, particularly organized philanthropic activity, they get a lot of really bright, there's a lot of really bright people in the field, but they're timid. They're more focused mm-hmm. on not making mistakes than they are in focused on learning.
Yeah.
I'm a devotee of what I call guerrilla philanthropy. That's where you go out in the middle of the night, you do some damage in a village, and then in the morning when the smoke clears, you look around and you say, so what happened here? What can we learn from it as before we move on to the next village? I hate to use the metaphor of war, but it's that being open to innovation, surprise, and discovery, rather than thinking you're going to get it all kind of planned out in advance. For me, clarity emerges from practice. Practice doesn't emerge from clarity. So you just need to get started, and you need to learn from what you're doing, revise your plans, and be adaptable. And practice some of these basic core principles. And I think whether you're a funder or a community agency or whether you're a young person just starting out on a career, you're going to be successful.
Well, Roger, I can't wait to see what your next success is, because when it comes to innovation and surprise and discovery, I know that that is what's next for you. And I just hope to be in some small part of it, because it really has been a joy to be able to work with you and with St. Luke's Health Initiatives over the past decade and a half or so.
Well, thanks, Hildy, and likewise. We've certainly enjoyed our association with you as well.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Speaking with Roger is always a pleasure for me. I confess that I frequently use case studies from SLHI's work when I speak and in my writings. I even use them as case study examples in the Pollyanna Principles. In each of those instances, it's not only SLHI's willingness to explore new ideas and new assumptions that has led to their creating change. It's also their willingness to integrate that new wisdom with their existing core values. I love Roger's story about the light bulb that went off for him as he realized that SLHI could look at their definition of health in the same way one would look at one's own children. Prior to the significant conversation Roger described, SLHI was a traditional health conversion foundation, providing grants to projects that defined health as the absence of illness. The new ideas that were generated from the organization's willingness to think differently than they had in the past transformed everything for the foundation. In addition to leveraging its dollars, SLHI began leveraging everything: its ability to convene, its wisdom and knowledge in the form of policy papers, its own research, and yes, its dollars, all towards its new vision of health as mind, body, and spirit in a responsive community. And it was all because the board and staff were not only willing, but as Roger noted, energized about what that new way of thinking would make possible. None of this happened overnight. It took time and the creation of an environment that would embrace new ideas, just as Roger noted. But it's so easy to fall into habits and patterns of thinking, doing things the way we've always done them. To be a real catalyst for change requires that we constantly add new thinking to the mix, that we embrace the new idea, the compelling vision, the invitation to think about something in a dramatically different way. Which leads to questions for your own work. What compelling vision leads your organization to explore what's possible for your community? How often do you discuss the ultimate difference you're hoping to make and for whom? As Roger and SLHI redefined community health as a description of a positive state rather than the absence of illness, what would that positive description of success look like for your mission in your community? From there, how might your organization grow a nurturing, safe environment to explore together? What conditions might lead your organization to creating a culture that fosters new ideas from within? And lastly, what would it take for your organization to consider trying something radically different than they had ever done before? Even if they don't dive in all the way, what might it take to put a toe in, to try on a new idea, to explore? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, at the Chronicle's Making Change group at LinkedIn, or at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.